Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. First on the program, we'll talk to Paul Grosswald from New Jersey Safe and Sound. That's an organization shedding light on the issue of undue influence.
Ha. And then we visit with Dave Hanscom about the Wasatch Citizen Series. Well, and a race scheduled for Saturday at White Pine. And we'll talk to him about how the season is shaping up.
Or not.
Or not. And whether the race will happen this Saturday.
Or not.
But it's looking good outside right now for this minute. So
those giant snowflakes you were commenting on have diminished in size.
Yeah, in the last 60 seconds, literally.
But that could be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So we love to talk to Dave Hanscom. He is always a great guest to talk about his enthusiasm and really this whole town's enthusiasm for Nordic skiing.
And finally, we explore the 5-day fasting mimicking diet presented by Dr. Walter Longo in his book, The Longevity Diet.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campus Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampusCoffee.com.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, New Jersey Safe and Sound was started to explore the ways that people get, express, and maintain what is known as undue influence over the life of others. While this may not be an issue first and foremost in your mind, it can and does present significant challenges and problems for people, families, and groups who are directly exposed to undue influence. Paul Grosswald joins us to explain the dimensions of the issue, how to recognize when influence exceeds healthy limits, and what can be done to support those impacted. Paul Grosswald, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thank you for having me. How are you?
Thanks for joining us. We've chosen you as a representative of this organization, which is just one of many across the nation that engages in this sort of thing to break someone away from undue influence. And maybe you could just start by explaining what undue influence is.
Okay, well, undue influence is the use of a person's role and power to exploit the trust, dependency, and fear of another person in order to deceptively gain control over that person's decision-making. So a person who's under undue influence will basically, they can't make their own decisions anymore. They'll need to ask permission if they want to go on a date with somebody or if they want to go or talk to their family. Or sometimes their communications will be monitored, or maybe they won't be allowed to have any communication with their family at all. And the family members will start to notice the person is undergoing a severe personality change. Suddenly their interests are completely different. They're no longer pursuing the goals and hobbies that they had beforehand. And the person's entire life is now devoted to supporting the person controlling them, the influencer, rather than pursuing their own self-interest.
And so go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say it's often very subtle, mm-hmm. right? Because anytime, you know, if you have a new boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, a person might be completely focused on this other person that they're in love with, right? So how do you distinguish a healthy relationship like that with undue influence? And it can be a very tricky thing. But the families that New Jersey Safe and Sound has come into contact with, it's usually pretty obvious. By the time they've contacted us, it's not just a normal relationship anymore. I mean, the person is not coming home anymore. They're not calling home. They're not talking to their family. They're missing birthdays. They're missing Christmas and Thanksgiving. And they just don't seem to have any interest in their prior family and friends that they used to have. And it's a drastic personality change. And it's heartbreaking for the families who are left behind when this happens.
So I think for those of us who have never experienced this with our loved ones, your definition makes us go to the thought of cults that we hear about in the media, usually after some really tragic crisis has occurred. But I would imagine you're about to tell me that it doesn't even have to be a cult. It can be, as you said, very subtle. So what do some of these relationships look like?
Okay, well, so the cult situation would be if you have like an organization, right, where there's a whole movement and with a leader and followers and it's organized. But what happens is undue influence can take place in a much less organized way. So it could be a one-on-one relationship where it's just one person dominating another person. So there's no formal organization. There's no formal structure. It's just one-on-one. It could also be a therapy relationship. You know, perhaps you go to see a psychologist or a counselor to get help with a problem, and then that the counselor takes advantage of the patient and establishes a dominant relationship using undue influence. It could be a teacher or a coach or somebody who's important in your life. So it doesn't have to have the formal organizational structure of a cult for there to be undue influence. What we're concerned about with New Jersey Safe and Sound is what we refer to as predatory alienation. Okay, so predatory alienation is when a person deliberately disrupts the other person's existing relationships. And that can happen in any type of context, whether it's a formal organizational structure like a cult, or whether it's just a more simpler relationship. What we're concerned about is people's relationships being disrupted by the undue influencer. That's what we're concerned about.
Paul, I'm really curious about how you determine, I don't even know how to frame this question, but this predatory alienation seems to have levels of degree and subtle nuances to it. So where is the line and who's drawing that line? And I'm fascinated by, you know, the fact that you've gone to the New Jersey State Legislature and asked them to explore this. And I understand they are doing that. So that would sort of create an institutionalized line in the sand to some degree, because otherwise I could sit here and think, you know, one person's predatory alienation is another person's change and evolution and giving up their old social network and choosing another path in life with other interests and other organizing principles. So how do you distinguish between just normal growth and evolution and leaving the past behind, shedding the past and choosing something new, and predatory alienation?
Okay, well, New Jersey Safe and Sound publishes, it's like a bookmark. You know, you can like use it as a bookmark, but it's a little chart which has a spectrum of influence, okay? So what we like to say is that the safe influence would be a relationship that nurtures your independence. It respects your other relationships and your other interests. It encourages you to access information, and it leaves you in control of your choices. That would be the healthy, influential relationship to be in. Now, the caution, the possible danger comes into play when you're in a relationship where one of the people in the relationship is disregarding your personal boundaries. They're pressuring your thoughts, your feelings, and your behavior, and they're isolating you, and they're leaving you feeling confused. When that starts to happen, those are warning signs that you might be in an unhealthy relationship. And then the real danger comes when you're in a relationship that fuels your fears. A relationship that controls all of your time, keeps you isolated from others, it demands unquestioning commitment, and leaves you obligated to get permission before making decisions. When you're in that type of relationship, it's dangerous. Now, I agree, it could be difficult to draw the line. But I think, and as for your question as to who's drawing the line, right now, there really is nobody drawing the line because the law, at least in New Jersey and in most other states, does not have a cause of action for alienation of affection. You know, there used to be a cause of action for alienation of affection back, you know, in days. You know, you used to be able to sue if a husband is married to a woman and then the woman falls in love with another man. You know, the husband used to be able to sue the other man for alienation of affection. And then in the mid-20th century, most of the states got rid of that cause of action because I guess the public opinion just got to the point where people didn't want personal relationships being litigated in court. It just didn't seem like an appropriate thing to be suing people over. So the cause of action was eliminated. The problem is they never made an exception for these abusive types of relationships. So you can have, say you have a cult where it's a big organization that makes millions of dollars, and the way they make their money is by pressuring people to turn over their life savings to the cult leader. And then the way they do that is they get people to cut off their relationships with their other family members so that when the family members try to say, stop giving all your money to the cult leader, the person's relationship is cut off, and then they join the cult and they give all their money over. Now that family might want to sue this organization saying, look, this organization is making millions of dollars by breaking up families. We should be able to sue. But because there's no cause of action for alienation of affection, they're not able to sue. And so the argument we're making is it might be okay to say to the husband or the jilted lover that, you know, we're not going to let you litigate your personal intimate relationship in court. But when you have predators who are making money and abusing people, that should still be actionable. So we're trying to find a way to carve out some legislative exception to the rule that prohibits alienation of affection from being a cause of action. And that's the tricky part because, as you've said, it does raise the concern of how do you draw the line. But I think I think lawyers are clever enough that it should be possible to be able to prove the difference between a healthy relationship and an unhealthy relationship. If you have a person who's never been abused by their family, and yet all of a sudden they don't want to come home anymore or talk to their family anymore, and for no other reason than that they're now in this new relationship, a reasonable person looking at that should be able to tell that there's some kind of abuse going on, that's not normal.
Yeah,
and that's what we're trying to raise attention about.
And I think it's a worthy cause and something that I quite honestly hadn't thought about too much, other than within the context of cults and maybe, you know, you hear about religious organizations and people giving all their money over to some cause. And that is, I think, from my perspective, and I'm sure from yours also, Paul, because I understand you're an attorney, so you understand the legal aspects of this. But, you know, I could make an argument in that nuanced fashion that we are all subjected to undue influence, in my personal opinion, from advertising and marketing. And this would open the door, I would think, to people suing soda companies, processed food manufacturers, because they were unduly influenced by television commercials that led to them eating too much of unhealthy foods and caused whatever ailment they have. And boy, wow, what a can of worms mm-hmm. that could be
well,
opened
I
up
think...
by this. And I know that, you know, you go through the process and you litigate and you refine the law and it evolves over time. But holy cow, I mean, it just seems like this is a big one.
But I think you can make a distinction, though. I mean, so the advertiser, okay, the Coca-Cola company that's putting these soda commercials out, they're not then saying don't ever watch a Pepsi commercial, right? They're not stopping you from looking at another advertisement. They're not telling you to stop talking to your family. If your family doesn't drink this soda, don't talk to your family anymore. Don't come home for Christmas if they're not drinking this soda. That's the abuse we're talking about. Simply putting a message out there on a massive scale might have influence, but it's not undue influence. And that's what, right, we're not opposed to all influence. We're opposed to the undue influence. So the influence becomes undue when it becomes abusive, when it involves separating people from their loved ones, or using fear and guilt and manipulation to make people, you know, terrified that something horrible is going to happen to them if they don't comply with what they're being told to do. And that's substantially different than advertisers putting a message out there in an open marketplace where people are free to digest the information and still get reality testing from everyone else in their life who they're not being disconnected from by the advertiser. Right? So I think there's a way to distinguish it. And again, I admit that it's nuanced, but there is a way to distinguish it.
We're speaking with Paul Grosswald. He's a representative of New Jersey Safe and Sound. And Paul, I just want to switch gears for a moment. We have just a few minutes left. We found your organization, and in looking through to find something similar in Utah, you know, there is an organization called holdingouthelp.org, and that is quite focused, however, and it's a group that we've interviewed on this program before. It's an organization in Utah that assists those who wish to leave the polygamist community. So that would be the fundamental Latter-day Saints and the polygamous communities, mostly in southern Utah. But if someone's listening to this conversation right now and they're wondering about their loved one, and I think about their loved ones being either an adolescent, a teenager, or on the other end, a senior citizen who you know, many seniors fall prey to and become victims to giving their money away over the phone or something like that. Could you talk about how you might find help locally?
Okay, well, so obviously, I guess if you're wherever you are, you want to try to find the groups that are that deal with this kind of issue. And one of the things that the New Jersey law did that we passed was it caused the state to do some research. And one of the recommendations that resulted from that research was there needs to be more education and more awareness in the community so that people will know where they can turn, right? Because if you don't have that, then people, you know, you could be in a polygamous community or in some kind of an abusive situation and not know where to go. And even if you know you're in trouble, if you don't know where to go, you're not going to be able to get the help. So we do need to have education on a community-wide level so that everybody gets the message that there are places that they can go. Once you know that there's a place you can go, most of these places are pretty good at finding ways to help you get out of the situation that you're in. You want to find an organization that can help you maybe get to a safe space or help you reconnect with the family and friends that you left behind who hopefully are willing to take you back, and that will give you a safe place to go. I think part of the problem is once a person has been cut off from their family and friends, they often lose so much contact that they don't have any place to go back to. So if you're dependent on your abuser for your food and your support and you have no money of your own and you can't take care of yourself without the abuser, you end up really, really trapped. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to try to get these organizations funded so that they can have the resources to provide for people when they're in this transition period coming out of an abusive relationship. And of course, that, you know, these organizations are often very low on funding, and it can just be very, very difficult to get people the help that they need.
Right. The website is NJ, as in New Jersey, njsafeandsound.org. And there's a really nice frequently asked question page that if our listeners are interested in looking this up, it's a great, just an informational question and answer about, you know, identifying if your loved one is being victim to predatory alienation and undue influence. Paul Grosswald, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's an interesting topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back in just a moment. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. Next up, talk of cross-country skiing and even cross-country ski racing if you're in a hurry.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design, Love your home.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doilney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, so far, this has not been a stellar Nordic ski season. Just look outside. But the show, or in this case, the race, must go on. Dave Hanscom now joins us to share what has been done to give Wasatch Citizens Series and their race participants every opportunity to hit the track. It's our annual check-in with Dave. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. On a lighter note here.
Yeah. So.
It's full of suspense.
It is.
This particular segment of the show. Because Dave said that everything will be determined about this Saturday's potential race, scheduled race, in the next 3 hours. What happens in the next 3 hours?
Right. Your show is a little premature to answer that question. This white stuff that's coming down is giving us hope.
It is giving us hope, but even as we speak, it looks like it's getting lighter. So we'll talk about the cross-country ski season so far, and you were able to pull off your first race, although I would imagine, and I didn't go to it, but I imagine the racers got dizzy going around and around in circles.
No,
at
actually,
Soldier Hollow.
We did something different. We did it 3 years ago as well, and we had a similar start to the winter when it was warm. They couldn't make a lot of snow at Soldier Hollow until mid-December. What they had available for us was about 0.7 kilometers of really fantastic snow from the stadium at Soldier Hollow up to the lodge. So we said, well, that's our only option. Let's do a sprint. So we had trials in the morning and finals after lunch, and people sprinted from the stadium up to the lodge. And based on results in the trials, we seeded people in the finals, and we had final results shortly after the race was over at 1 o'clock.
That sounds like fun. And this is the crux of the Wasatch Citizen Series. It's about having fun, and it's about the raffle afterwards or about the lunch served afterwards.
We did both of those, yes.
Great. So that was one of five races,
lots of
I
kids,
believe.
Lots of families. We had a good time.
Good, good. So give us an overview of the rest of the races for the season, hopefully this Saturday at White Pine at the golf course.
I'll hopefully give you an overview. Yeah, we're scheduled to race of 15 kilometers at White Pine on Saturday, and then a week from Saturday we're at Mountain Dell. This Saturday's race is 15 kilometers of skating, and a week from Saturday is 10 kilometers of classic skiing. You know, the weather's not looking great, but I gotta say the skiing at both White Pine and Mountain Dell has been fantastic. I'm amazed at what a lot of shoveling and really hard work grooming and moving snow and, you know, taking good care of the snow can do. So as of 2 days ago, the skiing at White Pine was wonderful. I skied the 5K loop, and, you know, there were a few places that needed a little shoveling, but we figured with all this new snow coming that we'd have plenty of snow to shovel over the bare spots, but
we'll see.
Dave, a few years ago, I spent a lot of time trekking over to Solitude, which I hate to do, quite honestly. I mean, you know, nobody wants to get in their car and have to travel to do any skate skiing. We're very spoiled in this community, and rightfully so. We have such amazing opportunities right here. But do you do races in other places like Solitude, or do you personally ever travel? I know you go up to the Mirror Lake because I've seen you up there. But
yeah,
we have some places where even in conditions like this locally, we can travel a little and find some decent skiing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Mirror Lake Highway has been great, by the way. It's just high enough, and they get a little more snow over there in the end of the Uinta Mountains. So that's been good skiing. And I don't drive to Solitude, but I prefer to drive east instead of... Anyway, to answer your question, no, we haven't done a race at Solitude for many years. There are a lot of reasons for that, but let's just say it didn't work out.
Yeah.
We got too big, and there were some grooming issues and that sort of thing, parking.
Well, I did like a few years ago when I went over to Solitude just for something different, although I hate the drive. But I also go to Mirror Lake from time to time. I've seen you up there, and I've seen you up there. Lynn, where have you been, and where do you like to go when conditions are like this in our backyard? Well, you like to go to Sun Valley, I think.
I like to go to Sun Valley.
Yeah, but, Sun Valley's been great this year.
And this is an opportunity for those Nordic enthusiasts to kind of check out some other places that aren't too far from home. Of course, there's Daniel's Summit, which I know you go there in the spring. And
Daniel's Summit is fantastic in the winter. And I haven't been up this year for various reasons, but they groom for snowmobiles, and it's really good skiing up there because it's at 8,000 feet. So I'm guessing that their skiing is fine.
And so if you talk about both both places where it's groomed for snowmobiles, Mirror Lake Highway as well as Daniel's Summit, is there the ability to, you know, it's multi-use, and do the snowmobilers and the cross-country skiers get along, and they're able to have mutual respect for each other?
Yeah, so Mirror Lake Highway a little less so than Daniel Summit. It seems like the people that take snowmobiles for rides up at Daniel Summit are renting them, and so they're not the high-speed, high-power, you know, people that just do this kind of thing because they like to go fast. So, but for the most part, Mirror Lake Highway is just fine. Occasionally, some yahoo will go by at 100 miles an hour and spray snow on you, but it's
few and far between.
Yeah.
So, quickly, and we're just about out of time, but this Saturday, the 15-kilometer race at the golf course, how do you find whether or not it's going to go off?
Okay, so there, if you go on the TUNA website, T-U-N-A, the Utah Nordic Alliance, their website is utahnordic.com. There'll be lots of information there. And we'll have it on the radio, too, I'm sure. Lou will tell people when he does his report in the morning.
That's right. So everyone, snow dance. Keep your fingers crossed that it stays cold in the next 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't look like it's doing much right now, so I'm not feeling too optimistic. Yeah, we thought about moving to Mountain Dell, but they have another event down there. So, and Soldier Hollow still doesn't have any more than their 7/10 of a kilometer. Mm-hmm. They've had snow making issues. And
it's really interesting to go from one of the best seasons ever to one of the worst seasons. Yeah. Last year, the problem with Nordic skiing was that there was so much great powder skiing out in the mountains that you wanted to leave the groomed for the powder. And this year, well, the problem is obvious.
I'm reminded of the winter of 76-77, which is the year after we wrote Wasatch Tours, and we didn't sell many books that second year because it was just like this one.
Yeah. Oh, well, Dave Hanscom, Wasatch Citizen Series, longtime race organizer, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Hope to see you out there on Saturday.
You bet.
And we'll be right back after these words.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics and KPCW supporter, providing knee and shoulder care focused on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing. We are now incorporating stem cell therapy and regenerative orthopedics. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our next guest, Dr. Walter Longo, believes the food that we eat activates stem cells and regeneration, slows the aging process, helps boost the immune system and fight disease, and optimizes our weight. He's written the book called The Longevity Diet, which features the 5-day fasting mimicking diet. And he joins us now to discuss how it all works. Dr. Longo, welcome to The Mountain Life. Oop. Well, we don't have him. Okay, let's give it another go. He's not on the line. But Well, Ethel gets him back on the line. Oh, wait, here he is. Dr. Walter Longo, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
Sorry, somehow we got cut off there when just before we read your intro. So we've given the intro to your new book called The Longevity Diet. And I have to say that late last night, I was reading this book and I was fascinated, first of all, by your personal story and then your photo on the back cover, which shows that somehow you have captured the ability to, well, practice what you preach. You look very young, but I figured it out. You must be around 50 years old. So nice job.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right. So the little town in Calabria, Italy, where you spent a lot of your youth, at least in the summers, I think it's called Molocchio, is one of those places in the world where there is a higher than usual existence of centenarians. We've heard about the town or the county in China and different little pockets around the world. And so this was one of the things that first fascinated you. What did you see there?
Well, I mean, I didn't really pay much attention for most of my life until I realized that what we were doing in the lab matched very well with these people were doing. And also realized that there were four centenarians at the same time in a town of 2,000 people, and that's extremely rare to see that. So at that time I started focusing more actually on something that I just had around all my life, because I grew up in that little town, or at least you know the summers were spent in that little town, and. So it was an incredible coincidence, I think. Yeah.
Right. And you probably wouldn't have gotten so interested in longevity and come to be the director of the longevity lab at USC had you not had the juxtaposition of the healthy living in this little town and the very unhealthy and preponderance of diet-related illnesses that you found when you moved to Chicago.
Yeah, so certainly the observation in Chicago, a lot of my relatives were from Italy, so it was very surprising that they had all kinds of diseases that I didn't really remember my relatives in Italy having, and so I thought it was very obvious, a lot of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, et cetera, and so I thought this is probably, the diet is probably involved. And it wasn't until a few years later that I got the opportunity to start studying this, but that was certainly one of the motivations.
You know, Dr. Longo, a few years ago, maybe four or five actually, we did an interview with somebody, and it was a fasting discussion. It was a discussion about fasting and the benefits of fasting and how fasting activates certain enzymes and proteins, and you rebuild brain matter versus when you're fully sated from meals, how you go into some other mode. So there's a whole, there's a whole reaction, chemical reaction and cellular reaction that happens. And I couldn't help but be reminded of that conversation of 4 or 5 years ago that we had. And I'd like to hear from you the difference between fasting and dieting and how you've connected those two.
Yes, I think that our contribution has been to show how fasting can lead to the destruction of multiple tissues and cells, and then the activation of stem cells and the sort of rebuilding of damaged tissues with healthy tissues, and then we also wanted to make this feasible for people. Understanding that fasting, water-only fasting, would not be doable. Most people would not be able to do it, and we learned this the hard way doing a clinical trial on cancer patients. And with water-only fasting, they didn't want to fast, and the oncologist didn't want them to fast. So we developed this fasting-mimicking diet, which is a 800 to 1,100 calorie a day diet that mimics fasting, meaning that if you give it to someone, it has effects that are very similar to those of water-only fast.
And we, again, there's all sorts of variations on this, but some diets call for no eating after 6 o'clock at night, and then it creates what is a synthetic fast, I guess. It's a real fast, but by prolonging the period of time that your body isn't processing food and minimizing the time that you're consuming food, you create this sort of pattern of fasting and what you call periodic fasting. Is it the same idea and concept as that? And I drink a green smoothie every morning, which was promoted to me as a similar concept, is that the body is going through a normal process of cleansing during the night, and by putting in a green drink in the morning, you prolong the period of time that your body is doing what it has been activated to do during the course of the night further into the day, and you don't take carbohydrates or proteins until noon or 11, and you've created, again, a period of fasting.
Yeah, it's very tricky. This is why I started the book with the five-pillar strategy, and I basically say we need to stop having this improvisation, especially because improvisation can hurt people. And I give you a very good example in your case. We now know from multiple epidemiological studies that skipping breakfast, and what you may be doing is simulating the skipping breakfast, is actually increasing cardiovascular disease and increasing mortality, overall mortality. This is not just one study, it's multiple studies. So it's not a good idea to skip breakfast, and it's probably not a good idea also to mimic skipping breakfast. Why? Nobody knows, right? It may be that the body goes into insulin-resistant mode, mm-hmm. And it may be something else. So this is time-restricted feeding I talk about in the book. And I talk about the fact that there is a sweet spot, which is about 12 to 13 hours, and there are no studies indicating, whether you look at centenarians, whether you look at epidemiological data or any other study, there is nothing indicating that 12 to 13-hour fasting period is detrimental. As you go higher than that, then you start seeing the problems that I just described, and also gallstone formation. It can get, the risk of developing gallstones can get up to almost twofold by having very long fasting periods between last meal and the first meal of the next day. So it's trickier than people realize, and this intermittent fasting, I think, is doing as much damage as is doing good, and I think we need to move into much more data-based and multiple-pillar understanding of what we're doing to avoid what happened in the calorie restriction field, which turned out to, if you look at the monkey studies, the poor monkeys were put on calorie restriction for 30 years, and it turned out to have no effects on their lifespan. So I think I'm afraid that intermittent fasting, these very frequent, poorly done interventions, are going to end up with the same problem.
I was feeling so good until about 3 minutes ago about my green smoothie.
Oh, there you go.
Now I have to go on a whole different program that I get to talk about for the next 4 years.
Yeah. No, I mean, that'd be good. They might be good at night, you know. So if you just have regular breakfast, you know, a healthy one, and then the smoothie could be something very good at night, and that would be consistent with multiple pillars. So centenarians often do that. Their last meal is a soup, for example. And that's very, very common with people that have a record longevity. But almost never you see them skipping breakfast.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Walter Longo. He's the director of the Longevity Institute at the University of Southern California and of the Program on Longevity and Cancer in Milan, Italy. And just wanted to ask you, it's kind of complicated to go over those five pillars, but maybe what we can do is go, I don't know, maybe you have an elevator pitch for the five pillars of longevity.
Yeah, so the five pillars is the method. And so you look at epidemiological studies. What happens to people if you look at 100,000 people, let's say having high protein diet or low protein diet? Then clinical studies, are there any randomization? So where you take some group of people, you put them on high protein, a group of people, you put them on low protein, and then you have basic science. What happens if you put mice on a high protein or low protein diet? And what are the mechanisms for it? And the major fourth pillar is the centenarian studies. Look around the world. What about Okinawans, Loma Linda people in California, Sardinians, Calabrians, people that have record longevity? Do they have a high protein or low protein? Well, it turns out that almost every piece of evidence is for low protein and not high protein diet, even though many, many people now, every day you hear about these high protein diets. And they're based on really almost no pillars at all. They're just based on the fact that people lose weight and they think it's good for them, right? So, and they go on this high protein diet, makes them look better. And so the argument, of course, backed by data, is that you can lose the same weight in a healthy way. And that's what the book talks about. And by the way, all my royalties go back to research and charity. So, the book is really out there to make people healthier, but do it in a well-founded way.
Ah, that's right. I'm wondering what you have found in your research about, you know, tailoring diets, whether or not it's your fasting mimicking diet or just our approach in general to food. I just feel better, I think, when I have more protein and less carbohydrates. I mean, are people different in how they respond to food? And does that tie into your longevity studies?
Well, I think the devil is in the detail. Mm-hmm. So you certainly, if you have certain type of carbohydrates, let's say you have starches, pasta, mm-hmm. bread, rice, or sugar, simple sugar, that causes an insulin spike. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what makes you feel not very, very well. Now, if instead you switch to what I say that the ideal meal, which is maybe say 50 grams of starches, rice or pasta, and then 300 grams of chickpeas, the garbanzo beans, and maybe 100 grams or 150 grams of vegetables. So if you have a minestrone, essentially, with low levels of pasta, most people will feel pretty good after that. So the high protein is not necessary to feel good, at least for the great majority of people. But of course, if you have, you know, a lot of sugar, that's gonna make you feel sleepy, and that's gonna create, of course, insulin resistance eventually, and obesity.
So the 800 to 1100 calories per day on the fasting mimicking diet is made up of, again, mostly fresh foods, whole foods, vegetables, and complex carbohydrates and little protein?
No, that's the everyday diet that is in the book, and there are recipes in there, and people can go out and just do their own. The fasting-mimicking diet, I made the mistake of giving an alternative in Italy to do their own. And it didn't work out very well. You know, people, this is really like a medicine. It's very powerful. And it should be done with the clinically tested kit. Again, I donate all my component of the financial gains of that to the Create Cures Foundation, which I started. But really for safety and efficacy, we felt that it's important to do it with the Prolon kit, it's called, and that's what was clinically tested. Now, in the book, I do describe generally what the fasting mimicking diet is. I didn't want people to feel like I'm forcing them to buy something, but I really discourage them from doing this diet on their own because it's much harder than people realize.
And Dr. Longo, if you could describe for us the scientific benefits of fasting and why we want to mimic fasting in our diet. So I'm curious about what actually happens at a cellular level when we fast.
Yes. So when we fast, of course, it depends on the length, right? So this is why I was saying intermittent fasting, whether you do 10 hours or 12 hours or even 24 hours, not much happens until about 2 days into the fast, right? After 2 days, you deplete the glycogen so that the reserve sugar is gone and the body switches to visceral fat, the belly fat. as the major reservoir, the tank, essentially, right? The fuel tank. Fuel tank becomes the belly fat. And then you start just burning that fat preferentially as a fuel source. And in doing that, you generate fatty acid and ketone bodies. So the famous ketogenic mode, right? And starting after a couple of days, the body realizes there is no more food coming in, and it starts breaking things down. You know, it breaks liver cells down, it breaks immune cells down, it starts breaking all kinds of things down. And A, because they consume energy, and B, because they're used as energy. So it burns the material, the sort of recycles things, right? And so at the same time, then stem cells become activated inside, and inside of the cell, the cell also gets ready to rebuild intracellularly. But none of this happens until the refeeding period. So when you refeed, then the growth factors and everything goes up. The stem cell and intracellular components go to work, and they start rebuilding everything. And it looks a lot like the embryonic developmental program. And it's probably the closest you're going to get to that. And we published a number of papers showing that the genes that are turned on are very similar to those that are turned on during embryonic and fetal development. So it's a very interesting and very powerful rebuilding program.
And is this a process that would have been normally happening at some point in human evolution? I mean, if we were to go back far enough, would we have seen this fasting pattern built in as part of the normal routine? And then I have to wonder, then, why weren't people living much longer thousands or millions of years ago? And that could be because they were being eaten by saber-toothed tigers or something. But, you know, it seems like longevity has increased. And at the same time, this process of being well-fed all the time does not allow for the recycling, which is incredibly beneficial for longevity.
Yeah, you know, the answer is complex. Of course, fasting has been a must for all organisms, not just people, bacteria and microorganisms and mice, etc. Now, people used to fast all the time. And, of course, that was very beneficial. And we suspect that fasting was like sleeping, right? It was used by the body as an evolved process to used by the body to regenerate, rebuild, fix things. Now we got rid of it. At the same time, we eliminated really so much the being killed by a tiger, but the infectious diseases. If you look at places that have minimal medical access in South America and Africa, people are full of bugs, essentially. And that killed human beings early in their 40s and 50s and 60s. Before they even have a chance to make it to old age. So now we suspect that if you have the right diet and also you have the right medical attention, the antibiotics, et cetera, so you don't die of infectious disease, and now you have an opportunity having the right diet and the regeneration, et cetera, to make it to very old ages. And that's why in the book I talk about 110 healthy. But I talk about people like Emma Morano and Salvatore Caruso, who I followed for years. They made it to 110 and even 117 healthy. So, you know, this is not a science fiction anymore. It's a reality. Of course, it's a rare reality. And the point is that by adopting all the right changes, we can have eventually this could be the average lifespan. It could be 110 and relatively healthy.
Wouldn't that be fun? We could all get done all those things that we've wanted to get done but don't have time to. If we just had an extra 20 or so years.
We're going to have to come up with a new saying. 100 is the new 50 or something like that.
Yeah, something like
there
that.
There you go. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. Well, first, it's quick. I love how many times you mention in your book chickpeas or garbanzo beans and olive oil. And what is the favorite way and the best, you know, most wholesome way to eat those? I mean, is it hummus?
Yeah, so this is a classic Italian dish, you know, from the south of Italy called pasta vianella. So maybe 50 grams or so, not very much pasta, or 50 or 60 grams, enough for people to enjoy it. And then, let's say, 300 grams of garbanzo beans and 100-150 grams of mixed vegetables. That is the ideal, and lots of olive oil on top of it, maybe 50 ml. So that is the ideal dish, I think. It is high nourishment. It's enough protein, but low protein, and it tastes great, at least to me and to a lot of people that I know. I think that's the kind of direction that it's good to go into. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. And then unrelated, but also quite prevalent in your book, is the talk about type 2 diabetes, which is the preventable one and the one that is possible to correct. You also include a section in there about this. Again, something that you saw in large quantities when you moved to Chicago. What is your hope for that in terms of the longevity diet?
Yeah, no, in that case, it's not just hope. We have published that last year on a randomized clinical trial. A lot of the great majority of pre-diabetic people that did three cycles, the FMD of the fasting mimicking diet, returned to their normal level of fasting glucose. So now we're running in Holland, we're running a clinical trial on type 2 diabetes. And in Italy, we're going to run a trial on the metabolic syndrome, meaning the pre-diabetes, the in-between state between healthy and diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So it's pretty clear that it can help tremendously. Now, I think we still have to demonstrate it for people that are already diagnosed with either metabolic syndrome or diabetes, but particularly for metabolic syndrome, we feel very optimistic, but also for diabetes, we feel very optimistic.
Our guest is Dr. Walter Longo. He's the director of the Longevity Institute at USC, the University of Southern California. He's also the founder of createcures.org. That's where all the profits from this book, The Longevity Diet, go. And Dr. Longo, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I love this book, The Longevity Diet, Discover the New Science Behind Stem Cell Activation and Regeneration to Slow Aging, Fight Disease, and Optimize Weight.
I've always wanted to fast.
Yes.
And I just can't.
Well, I like the mimicking fasting much better than the fasting.
I like the whole concept of fasting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do believe that, there's evidence to suggest there are great things to believe in as benefits from fasting. And mm-hmm. I just can't seem to get myself into fasting mode because I like food too much.
Food is good. Yes. Yes. But his this book is very readable, and he gives all kinds of examples. And I couldn't put it down, frankly. Well, let's thank our underwriters. Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Valley Behavioral Health,
Park City Mountain,
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation,
Davidson Orthopedics,
Jim Doilney and Mark Wingsgard with retail at New Park,
and Fairway Independent Mortgage.
Yes, and you've been listening to KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life today. I want to thank our guest, Paul Grosswald with New Jersey Safe and Sound, Dave Hanscom, Wasatch Citizen Series, and Dr. Walter Longo, The Longevity Diet.
Catch up on all the local news from Week in Review on KPCW every Sunday morning starting at 8 a.m. with Rick Bruff, supported by Coldwell Banker and Team Schlopi, TSREParkCity.com. KPCW. Now more than ever, we've got your Wasatch back.
Hi, I'm Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. My mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process and our resort area market at 1245 Deer Valley Drive or nanettebush.com.